Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, Arthur Scott Cheshire came to Chapel Hill the other day to visit his wife's family and to talk about his widely praised book, High as the Horse's Bridles. And he talked about that at Flyleaf Books. This book follows a child preacher into a new life, lost faith, broken marriage, and a poignant view of a grown son coming to terms with his father. Plus, at the end, visit back in time to put in perspective the search, the continuing search for life's meaning through religion. So, Scott Cheshire, that's my best summary of your book.
Thank you.
Can
for
you
having
do it better?
Me.
Well, first of all,
I got to say, I was thinking that was pretty great.
Thanks. Well, tell us first about your connection to Chapel Hill through your wife's
sure.
family. Tell us about them and how you happened to be back here.
Well, my wife slash manager. she's sitting here beside me, which is nice. Yeah, she's from Chapel Hill, and I'm from New York originally.
Tell us your wife's name.
Oh, please, of course.
Name, and her
of course.
Mama's name.
Yeah.
Where she went to school.
So her name is Kate Heinemann, and she's daughter of Don and Rose Heinemann, the very famous Chapel Hillians. So I met Kate when I was living in Atlanta quite some time ago, and she was living there, we hit it off. I think I chased her for about a year until she said, "You know, okay, I'll have a beer with you."
And what were you each doing in Atlanta?
Well, I'm from New York, but my family moved down south when I was about 16 to Atlanta, or more like outside Atlanta. And Kate was there working at CNN. I think we had some friends in common. And one day I think even my brother said one day, he was like, "Hey, I think I met someone who I think you'd like." And he was right.
That's fantastic. Well, let's catch up with your book. You heard my summary of it. Tell us about the book.
Yeah, sure. Well, it came out last year. And a lot of people like to ask about the title because it's
those
kind
of us who haven't read Revelations.
Exactly.
<recently.
laughs> Yeah. Or as funny as I heard recently someone on another, I wasn't on the show. It was just some kind of book podcast. And someone mentioned my book and I didn't expect that. They're like, "Oh, I'm going to read Scott Cheshire's High as a Horse and Bridles next," which of course made me smile. And then he said, "I heard it's a time traveling Western."
Well, it sort of is.
In a way, maybe, yeah. But it has a title that sounds kind of like a Western.
Well, the title is a clue to the challenges that we encounter as we read it. So tell us about where the title came from.
I think
from.
That's a lovely way to put it. It comes from the book of Revelation, which was and remains, I think, a book very important to certain strains in American kind of religious traditions. I grew up in a house that we studied that book quite a bit. And of course, the book is a mystery for, you know, over 2,000 years now. So it's a bestseller, let's put it that way. But in there, there's a line that refers to when Armageddon comes or the apocalypse or however you want to put it. And it says that the blood in the streets will run as high as the horse's bridles. And when I read that, it really struck me because it sounds quite poetic, almost sort of like a Cormac McCarthy novel, which can only help. But it also, while it's poetic, it's quite frightening if you think of the literal kind of vision of that. So I like the tension that it gives to the
book. So, I mean, when you were a little boy or young person, did you focus on this particular verse then, or did you pick it up in terms of just the whole apocalyptic and, you know, days
sure,
in
sure.
the end of the into the era
well, not
predictions.
That verse particularly, but I grew up in the Jehovah's Witness tradition. I'm no longer part of that. That book, the book of Revelation, is very important to that tradition. So we studied it quite a bit. Happening to grow up or surrounded with that sort of vocabulary, those
from
verses.
Revelations.
When
the end's going to come.
Exactly.
Or when Jesus is going to come back.
Yes, exactly. And that, especially, I would say, in the 1980s, you know, at the tail end of the Cold War, when not just religious apocalypse, but sort of the daily life here in America, I think, was suffused with the possible coming end. It's a a topic that really looms large for me, especially as a kid. I really felt like I was living in the middle of that. You know?
Well, maybe we'll come back. I'd love to come back to that. But this does inform particularly the first chapter or the first section of your book, which is compelling, I think. So tell us about the character. And I kept thinking, is this really Scott? But tell us about Josiah. Yeah.
So his name is Josiah Loudermilk. And this is funny. I believe there's a Loudermilk family in North Carolina, and I stole the name from them one day when I was having dinner at the Heinemann's house, and I had not picked a last name for the character, and someone mentioned that name, and I said, wow, what a fantastic name that is. So there's a little Chapel Hill trivia. So his name is Josiah Loudermilk, and the book is made up of three distinct parts that kind of work together but also separate from each other. And it opens up in 1980 in New York City. And Josiah is a prodigy. He's a kid preacher. He's about 12 years old. He's given many sorts of sermons at church, that kind of thing. But this is the occasion of his first large sermon. There's about 4,000 people there.
And this is in New York City?
In the inner city of Queens, in New York. Now, a lot of people find that to be quite strange, especially Southerners.
We think we have a monopoly on this kind
of religion. Yes, you do, but you don't. it's a phenomenon that is quite vibrant and healthy in the inner cities as well. And so we meet Josiah just prior to getting on stage. He's nervous. He's a kid, you know, but he's also a kind of a special kid. So he finally takes the stage and he begins to deliver this sermon. But in the midst of delivering the sermon, he has, quote unquote, a vision. And he delivers this vision that the world is going to end in the year 2000. And he's so charismatic, the kid, which I am not, but he is, that the entire audience is sort of taken up in the fervor of the moment, and they believe. And
so this is back in 1980. So it's not like it's coming tomorrow.
Right.
Is that right?
Yeah. But he had a good plan. He had 20 years. Yeah.
And that's I'm just trying to put myself in the shoes or the seats of the people who are there who are predisposed to believe in a prediction of the world's end and predisposed even more to take it from an authority figure, and that might be a child. And so he says it's going to be 20 years from now. I've got more than enough time to prepare.
I think so, yeah.
But it's a startling and definitive prediction that comes from a source outside himself.
Yes. And one might say, well, what source? Well, there's certainly, you know, the possibility of some sort of divine voice. But there's also, and it's explicitly said in the book, he's been hearing other people talk about this. And when I was a kid, that was certainly the case. There were quite a few dates thrown around. And not just in the particular church that I went to. Lots of places. Have you heard it? I mean, frankly, Reagan gave a few dates, you know? So it was in the kind of the consciousness of the time that there were, you know, lots of dates that were named. And he happens to fixate on this one for lots of reasons. I think even for those who are not, you know, say believers, just the year 2000 before it came really had a tremendous, you know, kind of
two
sense
millennia.
About it. Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
So what? He makes the prediction,
right, yeah.
And it gives him additional authority and more attention.
Yeah.
And how does this affect his out of church life?
Yeah, it's a good question. And frankly, after I wrote that opening, which took quite some time, I could not figure out what came next. And at some point, I decided the most interesting move was to imagine him no longer 12 or 13 or 15, but what happens to someone when they're a grown man, say 37, 38, 39, 40, what happens in that space?
I tell you what, before you do that real quickly before the break, he's extraordinary when he's in church.
Yeah.
But here's a 12-year-old boy who has to go to school, he has to play in the neighborhood. How does all of that work when you're a prophet?
Yeah.
You can sort of imagine, I mean, the question comes to me is—
Please.
How did Jesus, when he came back from teaching in the temple and go back into the neighborhood in Nazareth, how did he relate to the other kids?
You know, it's a super question. And what's funny is a lot of the the ideas I have in the book, such as having a kid preacher, may seem alien at first to some. But yeah, they're actually quite biblically based. I mean, we only have a few, you know, kind of visions of, you know, the Jesus of the Bible. And one of them is a kid, about 12 years old. Or we have kings that are about 12 years old, one named Josiah, actually, from the Bible. And it's kind of fascinating to imagine what kind of burden that might put upon a child's personality or expectations or mothers. I know that personally, I mean, I will say here and now I was not a prophet. But I was a kid who was good at giving sermons, and which is part of that tradition. They knock on your door, right? I mean, they have a message, and they're also kind of trained to be young ministers, and I did that, and I think I was pretty good at it. But I know that back at school, it was a real strain because to try and how can I put it, to balance being in the moment and enjoying the day, which I think is what kids are the best at, and balance that with what's going to happen later and what terrible things might happen later, that it puts a real strain, I think, on any child. And I think Josie is no exception.
He's has difficult relationships with some of his best friends.
Yeah, yeah.
And what about girls?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, in the church, he seems to be able to relate to the adults with more success than with other kids. And it makes him, in some rooms, the person to talk to. In other rooms, he's the person to ignore. And those are the rooms with his friends and his peers. And the better he gets at what he does, I think the more difficult it is for him to relate to kids his own age.
We're visiting with Scott Cheshire. We're talking about his book, High as the Horse's Bridles. And he and I will be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Scott Cheshire. He's visiting in Chapel Hill with his wife's family, and also he came to talk the other night at Flyleaf Books about this book. And it's an extraordinary book with lots of different dimensions. We've talked about, if you join us late, we've talked about the lead character of the book, Josiah Loudermilk, who was a boy preacher, 12 years old, got up in a mass meeting in New York and predicted the second coming in the year 2000. And he did this in 1980. And Scott, that's sort of, I wish we could talk more about that first section, but that kind of hits the highlights. What happens to this boy when he grows up?
Right, right. Well, I alluded to it before, which I think is a way of saying books are hard to write and they take a long time because there are no real rules except will you keep turning the pages or not, you know? And for a long time, I tried to imagine what should happen next. And eventually, I decided on making a huge leap for the imagination and also for the reader's expectations. I mean, when you turn the page after he sort of made everybody fill up with a kind of a Holy Spirit feeling, and you turn the page, you don't find out what happens next. And instead, you meet him sort of in the post end of his life, which is he's now 39, I believe, in the book, or 38. I kind of forget. But he's just lost his mom to illness. His wife has left him because he's been a terrible husband in a lot of ways. His dad is not doing well. His business is failing. He's generally unhappy, and he's lost a lot of the things that sort of make an adult work.
So your intention with this is to make us try to, at first, imagine how he got from 12 years old, successful preacher and acclaimed preacher to a once successful businessman who once had a beautiful romantic relationship with his wife, and happy generally, or if successful.
Sure.
He's now failing in almost everything, but we have to imagine him at first as a success. Then what do you do then? Do you answer those questions?
They sort of get answered as you get to know him. There are different kinds of books, and some books give you all the answers up front. And for whatever reason, I'm interested more in reading and writing books that help you get to know somebody. For instance, when you're at a party and you meet somebody, or I just met you, DG, you know, and we sit down and we give each other information about ourselves, but we don't know everything. You know, you get to know somebody through conversation. And I think of books that way. So when you meet Josiah, he's now called Josie, by the way. He's kind of made his name.
He's given up his biblical name.
Yes, he has. Yeah. And you just kind of meet him in the middle of a crisis in a way. And the answers you get, you do get them, but you get them as you spend days with him. You get to see him live his life.
Will you tell us a little bit about what we would find out?
Yeah, yeah. Sure, yeah.
From reading the book, I mean, to put him in better context, we know that he's failed at several of the important pieces of life.
I think what happens is, well, most importantly, his mom gets sick. So not too far after that happens in the opening section, he's a teenager, his mom gets ill. And I think what that does for him is it unseats a lot of the expectations one has with regard to being special. Well, if his family and he is special, then how come my mom is sick and is dying? And that begins to sort of crumble the sense he has of himself. Things start going wrong for him, but not because he's special or not special, but because he's human. Things go wrong for us, you know? So that happens, and we also find out that he gets his first girlfriend, she does not look or sound or worship like him. And this really sets up a rift between he and his family, too. His father, I think, has a real difficulty with giving up any of those, giving his son any leeway at all. And that makes for a real strained relationship, too.
Well, it's interesting. As a parent now, and as a grandparent, you know, we invest a lot in the expectations that we have, the hope for success. And I felt for Josiah's dad because our Gil, I guess his name was, that Gil's has, for a moment, has got the the promised child.
Yeah, yeah.
And who's deeply connected within their faith and their church and all of that. And then all of us, not all of a sudden, but at some point, Josiah moves away from this.
Yeah. Physically, even at some point, I mean, he picks up and leaves New York altogether. I would say in some ways he runs away to the West Coast. He goes to California, and he physically separates himself from his family.
What's his faith situation? What happens to that?
For me, that's the most interesting thing about him, because some have asked, when does he lose his faith? Well, I don't think he does. There's even a moment in the book where he says faith is not really a thing that you can ever lose. It sort of defines how you look at the world. He has a very particular perspective on the world. So what we do is we spend our time now with Josie, who may not have a faith that looks like yours or mine, but he's someone who's constantly looking for the world to mean something to him. And that can be, I think, a beautiful experience, but also can be exhausting. Mm. He's constantly trying to make the physical world mean something. He's looking for some kind of revelation, really, you know, I think is a good word for it.
Well, you set it up so that his wife, or his the woman he falls in love with, is, I think she's a translator of Jewish documents, and she is Jewish.
Yes, yes, and she's a translator of Hebrew poetry and biblical poetry.
So that I can imagine that there is a real convergence of interest. I mean, evangelicals are and other Christians are often, you know, ready to dive into the Old Testament.
Oh yeah,
And then there's this divide that when you come right down to the matters of faith and everything, doesn't jive. And you said Josie now has the remnants of his earlier quite certain faith, which, now what does that do to that? Does that have an impact on their relationship, or are they both sort of out of it in terms of
faith? I think it deeply does. I mean, maybe this is a bit shameless, but in the book they actually meet at a bookstore and he's holding a King James Bible and she makes a joke about what a bad translation it is. Kidding, of course. the reason I wanted to put him with someone like that, and it made sense to me, was that here's someone who has the very same interests, but from a completely different perspective, in that she cares deeply about the subject, as in, like, where does this come from? What do we know about this lovely book, about this thing that's influenced, you know, all of Western civilization? And here's this guy who may know the book really well, but actually doesn't really know much about it. So I think his bent toward literalism and her bent toward understanding this book as a document of real poetic and religious power made for a wall between them that they could never quite knock down. But it certainly, I think, helped him in some ways. She was his way of, I think, of maybe divorce is not the right word because they actually get divorced. But divorcing himself from the more literalist compulsion he had.
We're visiting with Scott Cheshire. We're talking about his book, High as the Horse's Bridles. We're talking about his lead character, Josiah, or Josie, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Scott Cheshire. He's the author of High as the Horse's Bridles. It is a complex book, and you're making it even more interesting than it was
since
you're reading. Just briefly, for anybody
Please.
Who did join us late, this is this book opens up with a look at the life of a boy preacher, 12 years old, who's predicting the end of the world in the year 2000, doing that in 1980. And then what Scott has done is to take to jump ahead into his life as an adult with a whole set of adult problems, having left behind his role as a minister, a preacher, or as a person with who feels that his faith is strong enough to share with other people. Now, what's your story? What are you going to do with him now?
Oh, right. What do you do with him now? Well, as you had mentioned before, he has a strained relationship with his dad, and he eventually runs off to California, gets married, you know, lives his life. And his mother, who had been sick in his teen years but got through it, gets sick again, and she passes. And what happens at that point is that I think the father, who Gil, who had, I think, was able to deal with it the first time when his wife got sick. But, of course, losing someone is entirely different. And I'm not sure he has the tools to deal with it. And so he takes his own sort of the things that help him with regard to kind of religious ritual, he uses them to try and how can I put it? It's almost as if he's trying to contact her. And he's displaying certain behaviors that we might now call maybe even, you know, crazy, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. But he's not that different, honestly, from what prophets did in the Hebrew Bible or the Old Testament. And I found it was fascinating to me to take somebody who had sort of even the story of Christ or someone else going out into the desert to kind of have visions or to commune with the divine. If you put that in the middle of Queens, New York, it can be quite surprising. That's sort of what he's doing, though.
This is his dad.
Yeah, I think so.
And so his dad is still associated with the church, notwithstanding the challenges
yeah.
and all of that. He's
very much
he's
so.
A,
yeah,
a believer.
Yeah,
and
very
he
much
is
so.
Someone who can find himself in direct communication with God on certain things.
Yeah,
and can get mad with God like those.
Yes, oh yeah,
people did.
Absolutely, you know, and I think we should. I mean, if that's what, if we take all of these questions, which I do seriously, I mean, we have reason to, you know, to get angry. Like, why is life so hard? You know, but of course, he's also an older man, and he's going through a hard time. So he starts to exhibit some signs also of not being entirely well, I'll put it that way. And Josie is told this, that your dad's not doing well, and he decides, I have to go back and visit my dad. So he finds his father now living in the home that he grew up in, but in complete disarray. It's falling apart. He's living sort of like what we imagine a hoarder might live like. There's cats have overrun the house. He seems to be losing his mind, but he's as faithful as ever at the same time. And so Josie is sort of in this spot where he doesn't know how to relate to the guy, but as simple as it might sound, he realizes if I just love my dad, maybe that's enough. And so they start to come back together simply by a son trying to treat his dad like his dad, and his dad treats his son like a son.
Well, we're getting towards the year 2000.
Yeah, <Past it? laughs> we're now past it at this point in the book. Yeah,
even though Josie has moved away from his connections to the church and to the spirit in which he gave these predictions, does it matter to him or to his friends or to his family that this authoritative prediction did not come true, or had everybody forgotten about it?
Right, yeah. Great question. I now that I think about it, I've not thought about this before, but I think it has a lot to do with why he ran to California, because no one knows. So he's not a failure, you know. He's not a failed prophet, whatever that might mean. But in his dad's world, his dad is as fervently and feverishly religious as he is, he has removed himself from the church he was a part of. And I think part of it is because of course, the church knows that Josie failed, but his dad, I think as a good dad does, wants to defend his son. So he's removed himself, and he still has a sort of allegiance, I think, to that, which is not so unheard of. I mean, there are scores of prophecies in the 20th century alone. We had one just in 2011. There was a guy named Harold Camping, who a fascinating figure, the prophecy did not come true, and everybody said, we missed a zero, you know, or we missed a one.
We checked our computations, yeah. And we have to adjust them.
Yes, it happens all the time, you know, and one of the things that's so fascinating to me and why I wanted to write the book is that Americans are really good at not just producing these sorts of religious hucksters / geniuses, but also really good at saying, we forgive you, you know, let us know when you got another number. It's a really rich and fascinating tradition of ours.
Well, how does the tension and the challenge of reassociating with Josiah's father, how does that make for a story? Mm. Is it just simply reminding us that relationships with parents is, particularly as they age, is often challenging, or is there more to it that you want your reader to think about?
Well, I think it's very true, what you just said, very true. But it's also, I mean, if I may get a little personal, when I was writing the book, I writing about a young man who leaves his religious family and tradition only to return at some point to get to know them, to kind of accept his own legacy. Like, this is where I come from. This is my blood. This is my family. At some point, that writer has to look in the mirror and say, hey, maybe that's me too.
So you're working out some of your own personal—
I think so, yeah.
As someone, if people join us late, they might not know that you were a voice preacher when you were growing up.
Left that part
of your background behind, and then you've had to go back home and deal with people that you left behind.
Of course, yeah. And it may sound exotic to some, and it sounds exotic to me, but of course at the time, it's just part of the life. You know, myself and my brothers were, and my friends were. But at some point, I'm not so sure it's different from anybody else, except by way of detail, you tend to leave the nest and you forge your own way. And in some ways you say, I'm not that, I'm this. That's how you build personality and character. But at some point you look at your family and you say, this is where I come from. I'd like to better understand them, which actually makes you better understand you, I think.
Well, in your particular case, was the break sort of a sudden when you went off to college and started hearing all this other stuff? And
right.
A sudden break, or did it happen inch by inch by inch, and then all of a sudden you realized I don't really believe what I thought I believed?
Right, yeah. A little bit of both. It doesn't happen in that you have this moment where a light bulb goes off and you say, I am not that, I am this. It's more inch by inch, for sure. But in my case, I started reading novels. I got really interested in fiction. And you can only do that at some point. You can only do it for so long until you realize, books are powerful. And when you read, say, a book like Moby Dick, and you realize how much comes from the Bible It makes you it forces you to reconsider the Bible as well, as a product not just of revelation, but of human insight. And really good novels perhaps are not just a product of human insight, but maybe they are part of some sort of divine voice too. Who knows? And so I started to devote my life to books. And spent a long time just not thinking about where I came from. I just physically removed myself from it. And it wasn't until I started writing this book that I started to deeply think about where I come from. And in that process, to be honest, I realized it wasn't just my family, but it was the first time I felt like an American, as cheesy as that sounds, because I realized, oh, I come from a tradition that is born here in America and is deeply American and strange. It's both at the same time, which maybe, you know, that maybe all things are. I don't
this
know.
This is a the Jehovah's Witnesses developed in America.
Yes, sort of yes.
Like
well, actually, all evangelicals have.
Latter-day Saints.
Yes, yeah. Seventh-day Adventists.
So these, you know, who are in the establishment churches have to say our churches came across the water. The churches that you're talking about and that you were a part of, these develop in America. They came out of the American experience.
Yeah, I mean they're American as football, to be honest. and it wasn't until writing the book that I really came to embrace that. And there's something really strange, like I said, but also rich and beautiful about that.
Well, we're visiting with Scott Cheshire. We're talking about his book, talking about and around his book, High as the Horse's Bridles, and also Scott's personal experience. We'll do some more of that after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. If you join us late, I'm visiting with Scott Cheshire. We're talking about his book, High as the Horse's Bridles. And Scott's in town, or came to town a little bit ago to talk to a group at Flyleaf Books and to visit his wife's family and her friends in Chapel Hill. But this is a wild book. and we've talked about the first sections, the boy preacher, the boy preacher who grows up and goes into business and gets married and has the kinds of troubles that many Americans have with parents, with spouses, with business, and just with who am I and what am I supposed to do?
Yeah, the stuff of life,
And so we wrestle with all of this through your book. And then at the end, you take us back 200 and some years, to show us as – I know. Well, I put this in my words,
Please.
But this is a question, so you
Please.
Reformulate it. And basically to show us that this religious tradition, these questions, this wrestling – this is not brand new that Americans on the frontier were coming up with some
doing the same
interesting
thing.
Religious. So first of all, if you would,
please,
tell us what's going on in this last section. And
and
do they have anything to do with the louder milks of the modern day?
Right, right. All totally good questions. Well, it's
you
funny.
Don't have to answer any of them. Just tell us.
I'll bring it on. At some point, I finished the book, and that section had not been written yet. And I was convinced I finished the book. And I was like, wow, I wrote the book. But something was missing. And then I didn't know what it was. And then I found myself reading histories of American religion, specifically one historian named John Butler, who's just an amazing man. And he had this fantastic book called Awash in the Sea of Faith. And it's a historical document of what it looked like here on the frontier in the 18th and 19th century. And how varied and various the communities were. I mean, you'd have homes of, say, Catholics living next to Pentecostals, living next to a Jewish family with atheists. I mean, it was much more it was much richer than we imagined.
Much more diverse than we imagined.
Absolutely.
It to be based on the Thanksgiving stories. And
absolutely,
the,
And when I read that, for some reason, I found myself all of a sudden writing about a 12-year-old boy, just like in the beginning, who is on his way, rather than to – in the beginning, Josiah is going to this his first large-scale convention, but he's been to plenty. I found myself writing about a 12-year-old boy who was going to his very first one. He'd never been to one before. And it was out there in the woods, in the frontier
like
of Kentucky.
A revival. We're
yes.
thinking of a revival context.
Yes, yes. This is...
Or camp meeting.
Yes,
context.
Absolutely. This is a, I mean, there historically, it happened in Cane Ridge, forgive me, in Kentucky, all along the frontier, generally known as the Second Great Awakening. And it was filled with charismatic preachers and boys, you know, young boys, you know, men, women of all stripes and colors and sizes and faiths, kind of going out to the frontier and building church communities for themselves. So I started writing about that. And then at some point I realized, wait a second, this is where this whole family comes from. This young boy, Orrin, is Orrin Loudermilk, and he's you eventually find out it's perhaps his. I haven't figured out how many greats he is, but he's a great
lineal ancestor.
Yes, of the Loudermilks. Yeah, and because it hit me that at some point this particular family's religious tradition has to start somewhere. Everything starts somewhere, and I said how interesting it would be to actually. Think about and write and portray the very beginnings of this particular bloodline, if that makes any sense. And it happened on frontier America, as far as I was concerned. But of course, ending the book at what feels like the beginning seems illogical in a lot of ways.
Yeah. But you made it make sense. What does happen in the? I mean, what is this religious experience that Orrin has?
Yeah. So Orrin finds himself. Alone at a farm, and his father's gone off to sell soap and luck jars. These are things of the time to go sell at one of these conventions, and he doesn't come back. So Orr finds himself nervous, and then a free black man, not a slave, a free black man, comes along and asks for water for his horses. And Orr is a curious kid. He wants to get off the farm. He's not seen much. And he decides to convince this man to take him with him on the road because he's headed the way where this convention is happening. So he goes on the road with this man. And they wind up at the convention. And these conventions were wild kind of occasions.
There was not just religion. There was some drinking and carousing.
Oh, lots of it. Yeah, it was a good time, you know. But tens of thousands of people sometimes showed up to these things. So he winds up at this thing. And there are thousands of people out in the hills. And he finds himself in a situation where he gets pulled up on stage. So he takes the stage much like Josiah does. So there's a lot of mirroring happening, you know, in the first and the last sections. And he winds up on stage. And what happens next is a kind of phenomenon that happened a lot of these occasions, which was people whirling and dancing in the name of Christ and kind of getting caught up in some sort of feverish moment. Charismatics, you know, really losing themselves in the religious moment. And by the hundreds, they fell to the floor. And so he watched this happen. And to him, of course, in his young eyes, he doesn't really know what to make of it. But he, too, has lost his mother, just like Josiah has. And he watches this woman stand up and he sees her and he's convinced it's his mother. So he has this very profound religious moment. But of course, as readers, mm-hmm. we wonder, what does that mean to have a religious moment, yet we know it's not actually divine?
So you raise the questions in Please. This context and then throughout the book that are you don't want to answer that question of whether or
I don't.
Not a communication from God is really some kind of mental illness or
right,
really is a direct communication. You let your reader make his or her own decision about that, or are you coming from one perspective or another?
Well, I think there are specific moments where we are all free to say, sir, ma'am, you are not talking to God. Because if God is what we'd like it to be, he's not telling you to do something that horrific. But I know that the books that I love are books that don't set up answers. They set up questions and they kind of they prod us a little bit and they stoke our fires to think about things. I like to think that I made a book that makes us wonder, what does it mean to have a profound moment? Is it possible it's both divine and human at the same time? I think so.
Well, this has been fun. and very stimulating.
I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
And the opportunity to visit with you in person. And I want to thank your wife, Kate, for making it possible for you to come and share with us your book and what you've learned. Hope you'll come back often.
Thanks so much.
Well, our guest has been Scott Tesher, who came to town to read and visit at Flyleaf Books and to visit his wife's family. We hope that they'll both come back soon and often.
I do too.
And thanks to you for listening. This is D.G. Martin, who's talking. I'll be back here before you know it.